This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Maybe at no time since the heyday of the civil rights movement has voting rights been so much in the news. For some years now, and especially since the Supreme Court struck down elements of the Voting Rights Act back in 2013, many states have made voting harder and less accessible. The measures they adopt are usually presented as ways to prevent voter fraud, but largely, if not entirely, these measures have been targeted at Democrats, and in particular, black voters, who mostly lean Democratic. A deep analysis of voter suppression was published recently, and it was entitled One Person, No Vote. The author is Carol Anderson, a professor at Emory University. And in her view, race and racism remain at the dead center of the problems around voting. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Yes, hi.
Now, you're talking to me now from Atlanta. And
yes.
When we heard that Stacey Abrams, who was running for governor of Georgia, herself was almost blocked from voting this November, we heard that it was only when that a poll worker told her that she'd already voted absentee. And in the end, the only way she was able to cast her vote in her telling was that she understood voting laws and she was able to advocate for herself. And probably the TV cameras trailing behind her didn't hurt her case either. But that should give us some sense of how complicated things were in Georgia, no?
Oh, absolutely. And deliberately complicated. The areas around Atlanta and in Atlanta, there was a 4.5-hour wait time because they didn't have the power cords for the voting machines. In the Atlanta University Center, which is where you have Morehouse and Spelman and Clark Atlanta, there were 2 working machines where there were supposed to be 9 working machines.
These are predominantly black areas.
Yes. They ran out of provisional ballots. I mean, prior to that time, there's this thing called exact match, which deals with voter registration. And it says that when you register to vote, then the Secretary of State, that would be Brian Kemp's office.
Brian Kemp, who was not only running the voting system, but also Stacey Abrams' opponent in the gubernatorial race and the eventual winner.
Right. If your name doesn't, if any of the information doesn't match up exactly with that the state has in its own database, like its driver's database, then your voter registration is put in this limbo. Well, the AP found that in August or somewhere in September or so, that 53,000 voter registrations had been put in this limbo, and 70% of them were African American.
So White Rage was the title of your last book, and white rage has shaped our country and our history, and it certainly shaped the 2016 election. Did you feel that white rage was a big element of the midterm elections as well?
As I define white rage, it is not what we think of in terms of like Charlottesville and the tiki torches, but it's the kind of methodical, systematic, bureaucratic power that undermines African Americans' advances. And what we see here is that rallying up to wipe out the possibility of a Stacey Abrams, to wipe out the possibility of an Andrew Gillum, to wipe out all of the kinds of remaining vestiges of Barack Obama. I mean, what you're seeing here is this kind of entrenched last gasp effort to continue to define America and American in terms of whiteness only.
Well, is it a death rattle, or is it this just going to be a persistent current forever, as long as we can imagine it in American public life?
I think part of what it's really going to take are that the majority of whites, and remember that the majority of whites who have not voted for a Democratic candidate for president since 1964, after Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, where the federal government put its power and authority behind recognizing African-American citizenship. That was the moment that you had the break with whites in the Democratic Party. And so it is going to require whites to move beyond this sense of a zero-sum game, that the only way that African-Americans can get will be at whites' expense. The only way that African-Americans can get to college, African-Americans can vote, African-Americans can have a job, African-Americans can have decent housing, African-Americans can have decent health care, all of that has to come at whites' expense. That is the framing that Donald Trump uses. And that's why you get the language of stolen elections. That's why that language is so powerful. It is about something being stolen from whites. And that is the conversation that whites have to have within their own communities, because this isn't about stealing from them. This is about empowering and making America stronger.
In the days before the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and between Reconstruction and then, there were all kinds of barriers to voting for African Americans, particularly in the South, mm-hmm. including, you know, being shown a jar of jelly beans and could you count the number of jelly beans in the jar, and preposterous things like that. It sounds like it is not, it's a bit more sophisticated, but the spirit of it is not a great deal different.
The spirit is the same, because the way that disfranchisement worked pre-1965, pre-Voting Rights Act, was to go after the characteristics, the societally imposed characteristics, be it illiteracy because we've underfunded black schools, be it poverty because of slavery and Jim Crow and disparate income. I mean, all of these things were designed to get around the 15th Amendment, that says that the right to vote shall not be abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And so you just take the characteristics. That's what is happening now once the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act.
Is it possible to give a number to this? How many black folks in general in this country were prevented from voting, or it was made extremely difficult for them to vote? Is there any way to put a number on this?
Yes, we've got some sense of this. We know, for instance, that in Wisconsin in the 2016 election, 8% of whites and 27% of African Americans were prevented from voting because of Wisconsin's voter ID laws. And note that these states recognize this when they write these laws. North Carolina knew it when it wrote its voter ID laws, which led the Fourth Circuit to say, you have targeted African Americans with nearly surgical precision.
Now, on the other hand, did it surprise you that in Florida, which is, you know, a pretty red state, they voted to re-enfranchise felons?
And that was a long-term nonpartisan movement, grassroots movement, that managed to frame that narrative that these are people who have served their time. They have paid their debt to society. How long are we going to continue to punish them? And so they were tapping at these multiple narratives in American society. And that felony disfranchisement law came out of Reconstruction in Florida in 1868. Mm-hmm. And it was a response to the Reconstruction Act of 1867 that provided that African American men had the right to vote. And so you see this kind of backlash against black voting, and that's what the felony disfranchisement law did.
Mm. Now, since the 2016 election, we've heard a lot about what Democrats need and should do to win in 2020, and a lot of that talk revolves around how can Democrats better appeal to Trump voters, and with the idea being that somehow the Democratic Party would reestablish the coalition it had in 1968 with Robert Kennedy, meaning working class people, minorities, as well as so-called urban elites. Now, your work would seem to suggest maybe a different approach. What would you say to Democratic strategists who are looking ahead to the next presidential election and want to win?
You will not win by trying to appeal to those where racism is their driver.
But are you suggesting that the entire Trump vote is racist, that the entire Trump vote is not to be impinged upon by Democratic appeal?
What I mean is that when we have a party, a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-class party that is then trying to make an appeal to those who believe that babies should be in cages, who believe that it is okay for police to shoot unarmed black people, who believe that there was nothing wrong that happened in Charlottesville, then how do you find that middle ground? You can't. You can't. You can't.
That's what I'm asking. In other words, how do you appeal to voters who say, look, I don't want to see mothers separated from children at the border, but there needs to be some rational immigration policy that's not open borders? And I'm posing this question like a certain kind of voter. Where do I go?
I remember seeing this article in Vox that went to, I think it was Whitley, Kentucky, where people were on the Affordable Care Act. And 80% voted for Trump. And the first question was, so how's your life changed by having access to health insurance? And they were raving about it. And then the reporter said, but you know that the Republicans want to do away with the Affordable Care Act. And they're like, yeah, we heard them say it, but they don't mean it. And I'm like, no, they really do mean it. And then came the piece. Yeah, but you know, there are those other people.
Yeah.
And they've got better health insurance than we do. And they don't deserve it.
Well, and now we're back to the subject that we started with, which is white rage. Mm-hmm. How does white rage, which has been a more or less a constant in American life,
yes,
how does it be eradicated? How does it burn itself out?
Whites really have to have the conversation with whites about how this thing really works, about the damage that it really does, and how it violates every principle that they say they hold dear. For instance, we spent $1 trillion on the war on drugs, basically to have mass incarceration of black people and brown people. And we know that the war on drugs doesn't work. It didn't work. But could you imagine what we could have done with that $1 trillion in terms of providing affordable access to college or affordable access to health care, or what we could have done for infrastructure and retraining for a green economy? I mean, these are the kinds of things that are life-changing. But when we focus in on that zero-sum game, that's when we do damage. White rage does damage. And we have to understand the depth of that damage.
Dr. Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate this conversation.
Carol Anderson is a professor at Emory University. And if you're interested, we did a long segment about voter fraud just about a year ago. And you can find that link on our Twitter feed at New Yorker Radio.
The cat sat on the mat. At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.